Matthew Talbot, how are you?
Even within my own party, fraudster. He's just a fraudster.
I slept rough on the streets of Manchester for just short 12 months.
Tell me you wouldn't break the law if it meant you'd have a roof over your head. But I've had phone calls from number 10. We don't think you're being very helpful.
Listen, the Prime Minister again has had a bad week. I'm getting bored of it now.
They all expect me to join Reform.
I love this. This is conspiratorial. Go on.
No, listen, I speak to Nigel's team a lot. I had a coffee with somebody who is unelected, has his entrails very much in number 10 despite not working there, and showed me text to the extent that it was his idea.
There are very few left-wing people not only allowed in this studio but this building, but this man, honestly, has a brain that says I can see both sides.
I might be a traitor, but I just think, I'm not asked.
You're doing a lot more media now.
I saw you yesterday.
You were with Sadiq yesterday.
Yeah, no, it's good. Sadiq actually seemed to get it, the homelessness thing. Like, you know, he's and I think what helped is he had people who with lived experience on a panel who spoke really movingly. There was one girl who broke down talking about her experiences, saying, you know, at some point you run out of friends whose sofas you can live on and friends that might help you out, family, etc., which is totally true.
Was that your experience?
Yeah, totally. People get pissed off with you. Yeah. You know, it's my best friend in all the world, ended up going, lad, I can't do this anymore. Yeah. And he's still my best friend in all the world, but when you're living on top of each other, you might be best mates, different living together, you're at weird points in your lives as well when you're younger and whatnot. So she broke down, and I thought, oh, I'm going to start going in a minute. I was sat in the front with Quajo, and I looked and said, I can't. Because in a way, also, it takes you back a little bit, and I thought, fucking hell. But no, Sadiq's team are really good. They said, you know, we'd like you to ask him some questions and put some stuff out, and they said, do you want to come as media or a stakeholder? I thought, no, I'm willing to help. I'm not here to, like, you know, get on his case or whatever. I mean, he's got to follow through, obviously, otherwise I will be getting on his case. But, yeah, no, he seemed to get it. I liked it. It was good. It's good.
It's good to hear that there's, you know, finally...
Yeah, people...
I'm hoping he's trying to nudge. I think he's trying to nudge government, and government have been far too slow. They're still not up and running with any sort of proper task force. What happened is government departments don't talk to one another, so it just won't happen, and it's a shame. And actually, one of the big drivers of it was Sue Gray, who's obviously not there anymore.
Right.
And I know Angela cares about it a lot, but it's
just not high up. I mean, we probably should have done an intro, but we're here today with Matt Talbot. Matt, our first ever guest on What's Left. Welcome. How does it feel?
Privileged. Honoured.
Look, one day when we get, who's going to be like, who's my number one get? Maybe like Ryan chatting from Fontaine's. I can tell him Matt Talbot was in that part.
And he'll go, oh my
who's
God.
Who do you want to get? Who's like on top of your list to get on?
You know what? I've not really even thought about it, to be honest.
Go on, I'll put you on the spot.
He's buzzing to me.
Matt Talbot. Matt Talbot. There you go. Well, you're welcome to Matt. You're welcome. I sorted this one out. I sorted this out through Sharon, your partner. You guys are a little bit of like a social media, you know, political power couple.
People
isn't
have
it?
Been saying power couple. Hold on.
So, how did you two meet?
Like every good 21st century romance, through Instagram and social media.
You slid.
I slid. Of course,
slid.
She
slid.
She went sliding. No, do you know the funny story is I went in it with no romantic intentions. Genuine. It's obviously like ridiculously attractive. Yeah. But I saw an interview she did.
Wait, hold on. Are we meant to believe no romantic intention?
Genuinely.
Oh, okay, all right.
Genuinely.
Yeah, right.
I was seeing someone at the time, actually. That's not my style.
Oh, okay.
So, I'll tell you why. So she, and this is where I get the win, she followed me first because she saw the first bit of media I ever did was with Politics Joe talking about Suella Braverman. She must have seen it. She'd followed me. And she followed me on Twitter. I thought, I'll send her one on Instagram. You know, And she gave an interview a few months after I'd followed her saying that she had political ambitions. Now, I knew I was coming to the end of my time with the MP I was with because I knew they'd move on after the election, would be a government whip, wouldn't need somebody, etc. So I thought, this would be the next project. Sharon was going to be my next project. I was like, right, this is great. She's totally sellable, already got a platform, already got contacts. Like, she looks good, she sounds good. I thought, this would be great. We've got the Love Island to Parliament like pipeline. This would be the first one. We got chatting. She stopped seeing who she was seeing. I'd stopped seeing who I was seeing. We met formally at a Labour Party conference, and I fell for her. Simple as that. Like, I've never felt like that.
Hard.
Never felt like that in my life.
Scrape the knees.
And I was like, ouch. oh my God, like, what do I do?
What was it? You were talking about policy and then she looked in the eyes.
You know what, I can't remember. She remembers. We apparently went for breakfast and it lasted 2 hours.
Right, you were
I
just
don't remember
riffing.
It being that
you
long. Were just we
That's
chatting.
When you know, innit? That's
yeah,
when you
it was
know.
Natural.
That
is it was when natural. You know. And then we'd met up a couple of times and then she said, do you want to go for a coffee? When I'm in London, I'm like,
and you were gassed. You were gassed.
I was like, what's happening? You know what I mean? This is good.
Yeah, man.
And yeah, it's sort of, I can't remember how it sort of happened, but you know, these things happen. Yeah, and she kept wanting to see me, and I was like, well, I'm not going to say no. And then, yeah, it blossomed from there.
So Sharon wants to, has a political ambitions. You said you came to the end of your time in Parliament. So is that the end of your political ambitions? Do you want to be like a commentator now going on the radio shows, or is it more like, actually, one day it would be good to go and directly get involved again?
I don't know. I would like to influence. I would like to change laws. I would like to change the country in some sort of minor way, in any way I can. I'd never say never to the MP thing, but sometimes it's just not worth it.
Is that hard though? Have you still got a criminal record from back?
Yeah,
in
I'll
day?
Always have it. I'd have to declare it. I don't know if that means it's null and void. It's, if you do an enhanced check, if really, you want to work with kids or be a teacher or whatever, it'll come up for certain job roles. But I'd have to declare it. Yeah, I was.
But that seems a bit mad though, because obviously you've done so much important and good work to have that thing still in the past stop you. Because I've got a close family member who's got a criminal record, who then worked in reparations, right? So worked with young people to precisely stop the pathway that he went on. And it's, you know, he still can't get certain jobs because of it. And I just think, is there a threshold that we as a society should then you reach that you go, actually, this person should be allowed to take these roles on? In fact, their lived experience might even make them better at doing that job.
I think, well, listen, I've come to terms with it. It used to wind me up when I was first, I suppose, entering a bit of the next journey of like post getting into trouble. And that's how I became political, weirdly. So I had no interest in politics, didn't care who the Prime Minister was and that sort of stuff. The news was always on in the house, but Mum and Dad weren't political. I wasn't political. None of the family were political necessarily. And coming through, getting into trouble, I thought, this is, and I'm writing about this at the minute for hopefully a book that will go somewhere. You end up with what I feel is like invisible barriers constantly in your way. And you ask anybody that's been in trouble and tries to play by the rules, essentially, afterwards, there'll always be things that mean you can't, which is why reoffending becomes so tempting, because you go, well, I can just quickly go and nick, you know, it's a quick phone, you know what I mean? Or, you know, that isn't the stuff I was into, but you see why half a grand for a watch or something, you know, it's easily done. So I got political because I thought, right, I've gone to college, I've gone to go and get my GCSEs, the idea was to go to university, I wanted to be a mental health nurse, I struggled with my mental health, I was like, I want to go and help people, this is what I want to do. Done my community service, done everything, you know, other than it not being spent, you know, I've done my time essentially. And I wanted a part-time job at Sky, they had a base in Stockport, and everyone at college seemed to be doing it. And I just about had enough, basically, I thought, you know, I'm either upfront with you, and you don't give me the job, or I lie about it, might get the job, and then when you do the DBS, you go, he's lied on his CV, he needs to go. Yeah, so I thought, what am I supposed to do? So I got political because I thought, it's not on this. And in my sort of naive mind at the time, I was like, right, I'm going to write to my MP. Because the guy on the phone said, listen, it's the law, data protection. I thought, I'm going to write to my MP. They make the laws, they can change the laws, I'm going to write to her. And then always being a little bit creative and a bit of a gobshite, really, I thought, nah, I'm going to interview my MP. And then I thought, no. Why don't I interview MPs plural? And I sort of got on a bit of a soapbox. So I went essentially around the country on mega buses because I had no money. It was bloody awful at times. I interviewed first guy, to be fair, that said yes was Jonathan Aitken, who got done for perverting the course of justice when a Tory MP in the 90s. He was talked about as a future Tory leader. I interviewed him for an hour and he disagreed with pretty much everything that I said. I'll come back to him in a minute why he actually was the difference. So I went and interviewed Andy Burnham. It got to a point where he'd agreed with everything that I'd said. But because I'd interviewed a few people up to this point, I thought, this dude, my fucking head in. He's not. So in the end, I said, right, all you've done is agree with me for 45 minutes. What have you done about it? Yeah. And he went, yeah, it's fair enough, mate, to be honest. Like, he said, I like your attitude. He said, do you want to come and shadow me in Parliament? Basically, Jonathan Aitken ended up writing a paper for the Centre for Social Justice with a lot of what I'd said to him in it. I've only found this out last few years because of the stuff I'd said to him and the stuff that he put in to Simon Hughes, who was the Justice Minister at the time in the coalition. My record would only have to be declared in half the amount of time than it currently had. So it would have been 5 years plus whatever I got, which was 12 months suspended. So it would have been 6 years and I wouldn't have to declare it anymore publicly. It would have been 11 previously. And I then thought, well, if a gobshite from Stockport can change the law, imagine what I could do in the building. Exactly. Now, what you find is once you get in the building, you can do more outside of it, unfortunately, because of the tribal nature of politics. Yeah. Blue team don't want to give a red team a win and vice versa. I had a really interesting coffee with James McMurdoch from Reform, actually.
Oh, really?
Because most people just wouldn't entertain that. No. Now, the interesting thing was, I did an interview where I spoke about my past. He saw it and he said, I need to thank you. Because of the changes you forced in law, it meant I could set up a 5-year plan similar to what I would have done, and that allowed me to get on with my life quicker, turn it around. And he said, I'm sat as an MP right now. Now, some people listening will go, fuck's sake, why have you done that? You've ended up letting someone like him in there.
You crossed my mind.
However, listen, I can only go off the guy on face value. He was sound with me, and he said he wanted to start looking at putting in Westminster Hall. He didn't want to be the guy that, you know, essentially who wants to be the guy that sort of levered his missus or whatever and you know, turned it round. But he wants to look at how, because this is where me and him would agree, when's enough enough? So yeah, I will always be, and I've settled with this in my mind, to some people it'll be, you've done really well. Yeah. To some people, even within my own party, fraudster, he's just a fraudster, he's, you know, this convict and whatever, and I think, well, that's all right. I will try and persuade you, but if you don't want to be persuaded, like, that's fine.
How do you respond to that, like, in the immediacy when that is kind of confronted with you, when someone's like, you're this or you're that, when you're kind of trying to challenge a narrative and kind of push through and also enable other people who have been in a similar circumstance to do all of the things that you've done?
In a way, I used to get more angrier about it. I think you just get older and you just go, right, whatever, like, who are they anyway? Or, you know, whoever it is. I would always say, I tell you what, imagine yourself on the streets at 15 and tell me what you wouldn't have done to get off the streets when you're getting pissed on and you're getting beaten up and you're getting cold and ill and there's no way forward and you wake up every morning and the shit starts again and you're filthy and you've not brushed your teeth for 10 days and people are laughing at you. Nobody speaks to you for 2 weeks, even when you're asking for change, and the demoralising feeling of asking for change and the humiliation and the judgment of people, essentially. Tell me you wouldn't break the law if it meant you'd have a roof over your head, regardless of what that was. Mm. You know, it was, I'm not going to defend myself because it was wrong and I paid the price. But ultimately, when is enough enough? Have I got to be constantly that guy? It was 15 years ago now.
Yeah, that's
and, and in a way, I've made it my centre point now because I see it as a story to try and get stuff done.
Yeah, so I think it's refreshing to hear it, to be honest with you, because I think one of the things I worry about is, like, what do we do around accountability? Because if accountability is a zero-sum game, right, if I hold my hands up and say I've done this and it's wrong and you still get punished for it indefinitely, then from the perspective of a person who's done a wrong, they shouldn't own up to it. In their view, it's not going to come out into their interest. The circumstance, yeah. And we don't want to go there. We don't want to create that. That's why I think you've got this pipeline here of male influencers who... might be big in the movie industry or big in one of the creative arts, and then they get called out for their bad behavior, which is bad stuff, and they should be called out on it. And then they grift and they go, all right, because they know that there's an audience there to flip the narrative, you know, gaslight people, scapegoat people in the opposite direction. But I think those people are thinking, well, if I owned up to it, I wouldn't have a life, I wouldn't have a career, it would be the end. So the only way I could prolong myself is by doing that thing. And I think we need to kill that off. People need to be punished, but also people need to be given space to change.
Yeah, they need to have the license to acknowledge what they've done.
I can live with myself because I take accountability for my actions. If people want to go, well, he's this and he's that, that's all right. I'll go to bed at night. I'll sleep. You know, as long as, and actually, it's not just me. It's the people I love and care about and the people that love and care for me. If my mum and dad think I'm doing all right, well, that's fine. Now, if they think I do need to pull my weight on something or I've done something wrong, well, they'll tell me.
And you'll listen. And you'll.
Well, not always, but depends what it is. But yeah, no, I think the internet especially is just noise.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I found myself getting a bit down with it this week because I thought, people are horrible, aren't they? Like, people are literally
Do you get a lot of hate?
I get a lot of praise because I've been calling out the government. As soon as I want to call out other party leaders or go, actually, the government's done
a good
thing.
Or defend the government, then you get a bit shit.
Oh, well, he's been called in now by the parties, or the left are going to run away from him, so he's now trying to save his career. I think what people need to understand about doing things like punditry, if the phone stopped ringing tomorrow, I'd be sound. I just won't talk about it anymore. It's not my... People call it a career. I don't see it as a career. I'm enjoying it whilst it lasts. I would like to get into presenting, not even necessarily in politics. Listen, if you can get me The One Show or Homes Under the Hammer or actually Place in the Sun and you're on £1 million a year, yeah, see you later. I'll go and do a Place in the Sun and, you know, do
Country
very
Files, my bid.
Country, yeah, Country Files, another one. I don't...
Match of the day, bro. That's, you know, it's open now.
I just think that's fine. But if not, I'm meant to go and do something else. I'll campaign. I'll go and stack shelves and work in bars again. I loved it. So I've had phone calls. You've had the same problem. I've had phone calls from Number 10. We don't think you're being very helpful. Yeah. Well, you're not paying me. So why would it be helpful? I'm telling the truth. Yeah.
And there's also a duty to the country more so than anything. The reason why kind of we're interested in all this stuff is because you care about people in your society. And so there's always an obligation to pursue the interests of people and kind of the country more so than the party on every occasion.
With regards to media, I think if people see it as a career, well, authenticity sells. So this is why I'm objectively myself.
Yourself, I know.
And it seems to... Because they people really are so used to a facade.
That's what...
Some do. They go, this guy's really, you know, breath of fresh air. Yeah, because I'm saying the winter fuel cuts
exactly,
are wrong.
Yeah.
But then loads of people say that. Maybe not, you know, in front of a camera. But as soon as it's, well, what reform going to do about it? Oh, well, my sort of weird fan base that has appeared off GB News and other right-wing ones, they all expect me to join reform. Which is like hilarious to me. It's just not my bag. I get the whole anti-establishment shtick. I joined the party like lots of people because of Jeremy. I was like, I've had enough of this. You know, there needs to be better. Yeah. Doesn't mean I trade it all in for battering immigrants.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
Like,
I know.
I just think, you know.
I feel like a lot of us learned pragmatism through the Corbyn mission, though. Do you know what I mean? We learned on the job.
I would say I'm a pragmatist more than anything.
We learned on the job that you can't achieve everything through idealism.
But you still have to retain a sense of idealism in all of it, I think.
Course,
you still have to know.
Mission.
Yeah, there is a moral mission. Yeah. And it's knowing that not only do these ideas exist in a vacuum, but there is like an absence of kind of that perspective in political life and public life. And so there's an obligation, I think, to kind of hold on to that idealism and kind of keep going and holding people accountable along the way.
Yeah, and I think that the maybe us losing a bit of connection with our idealism is part of the problem in projecting and communicating what this
definitely
the mission of this government is, because we've been responding and reacting to all of these difficult issues and the volatility of these. Let's talk about winter fuel, for instance, right? I felt that the winter fuel payment needed a change, like from a practical perspective, right? It didn't make sense to me that really rich people got this one-off payment when we know what the public purse is like right now. But I think the politics of it was done really badly. Why doesn't... Do you agree with that?
I can see the argument. I think if rich people get it, fine, that's the beauty of universal benefits. I think as long as those that need it get it, if some people get 300 quid that don't need it, it's 300 quid, like whatever. They'll spend that on a nice night out, you know, in some Richmond townhouse or whatever. Like that's fine. If we're going to means test... I'm not against it, but the problem is that costs money to means test as well. So sometimes it's easier to let things be. I think my biggest issue with it was that there's no mandate for it. So I consistently keep saying that the four most unpopular decisions Labour have made as a government are the winter fuel by far, the welfare reforms that may well get watered down but are still proposed, the national insurance contributions rise, or business people going out of business, small and medium businesses being hit left, right and centre, and in fairness, I agree from a fairness point of view, but the inheritance tax loophole being closed for farmers. None of that was in the manifesto. Right. So you cannot promise change, but not tell people what that change is. Now, I think we were in such a... I wouldn't even say we were in a strong position. I always thought, from knocking on the doors and just perception of people, that we were never 20 points ahead. Tories were 20 points ahead.
No one likes us. We were as many points ahead as it came.
Were so done... Yeah. The Tories, that we could have put all four of those things in the manifesto and still won. Might not be as big of a majority, but I think we would have won.
I don't know, because I think that there was a real concern internally to not make it a tax election. Because obviously the Tories are trying to push.
Well, they tried,
They tried really hard. Do you remember the debate? Mm-hmm.
Labour will raise your taxes. In their DNA. Your work, your car, your pension.
Thank you. Okay.
You name
it. Sorry, I am going to...
Labour will tax it.
And I think because of the past and campaigns historically where it did become a tax election, we could have struggled. I'm like, look, 9 months on, I think we should have said and been honest. And I think we should have said, we're going to need to make tax rises. I think we should have had
but
to
that should that. Have been kind of provided through a social lens of these tax rises are going to facilitate a kind of more prosperous, a more inclusive, a more dynamic
services.
Society.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Where all of those kind of idealistic visions that we have for what we want to live in can be properly funded and accorded to some of the most desperate people that have emerged over the last 14 years. I think that is to undo or understate the character of British people. I think broadly speaking, people across our country want not only ourselves but other people to live with a sense of dignity. And I think to reduce it solely to an economic lens does a disservice to the whole essence of what a Labour government is trying to achieve. Of course, there are economic and kind of fiscal confines that a government has to operate in. I completely accept that. But then at the same time, that doesn't mean that that should be an excuse to not have a plan around homelessness, for example, or not have a plan around further education or higher education as to how that could be funded, or when it comes to the NHS, more innovative ways of investing in the NHS and allocating resources. So I kind of think Labour has to have as much of a kind of social and, as you say, a moral mission when kind of making the finances add up, which I think has been lost to a point.
You would have saved some pretty bad optics as well. I still remain of the opinion that rather than raising the pittance of money that you got from the farmers who were all down Whitehall and the optics and the idea of Doris freezing to death at home, we were lucky we had a mild winter, actually. We got away with that. You could have put a corporation tax by 1% and raised triple the amount of money.
Exactly.
And you wouldn't have had all the city boys in their barbers and their gilets outside the front of Parliament.
Exactly.
You know, you'd have had the papers saying Labour are whacking business. Well, that's half expected anyway from most people.
Just a sense of kind of balancing, I think, the equation. For so long, it's been disproportionately beneficial to the kind of financial kind of sector of our society, which, of course, creates prosperity to a point in our country, but no more so than people like my dad's a mechanic, or people like my mum who's in the NHS, or the train drivers or the nurses or whoever it may be. I think there's a kind of disparity in what we perceive or who we perceive those who create wealth in our society and
who they are.
And that has to be done away with, because it means that we create or place greater value into some sectors of the economy and certain people rather than the ordinary working men and women who go to work day in, day out, sustain the country. As we've seen with the strikes, when the working class don't go to work, the country grinds to a halt.
That's always been the way. And I think it's about fairness. And this is the thing I think Farage has tapped in very cleverly to. British people in particular, maybe it's the case all over, but I think fairness seems to be an implicitly British trait. Mm-hmm. The idea of fairness is why we queue and stuff, right? It's like, no, I've waited here, I'm getting ahead of you. Farage has done it particularly well with immigrants, and we've almost gone back to an era of David Blunkett New Labour where there's a perception of people coming across the channel
skipping
the queue ahead of you. Mm. And that way people are going, that's not
unfair.
Fair. Mm-hmm. I've got no money. This isn't fair. Why can't I get in the hospital? That's not fair. And I think that's what the tax rises should be about painting the country as. We need to redress and rebalance things, mostly because them lot have cut everything to ribbons over the last 14 years. So don't forget them.
And people have got richer at the same time.
Of course they have. So we want to be able to be fair with people and right with people. Now you get your right-wing media circle saying, you know, it's not fair to Joe Bloggs with his 100 million quid and he's going to have to pay extra capital gains.
They own 26 properties.
Well, this is it. But I think that, I really think that is not the politics of envy. It's an easy argument to win in this current climate.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think, but if you, we're enacting policies that are reminiscent of like a George Osborne, Cameron.
Exactly.
But you have to say that at least they like tailed and made it clear to the electorate what they were going to do. There was an appetite for cuts in 2010 because they were honest that they were going to be austere, right? Mm-hmm. Like that was, they'd communicated that to the electorate, and then when they did it, it looked muscular and people were like, yeah, because you said that you were going to do this. It probably cost them the majority as well in 2010.
But also, I think it's a slightly different time. Before the financial crash in 2008, the economy was doing well. Mm. So people had felt a little bit of the pinch of the financial crash and they'd gone, right, Labour have ruined it, it's Labour's fault, Tories blamed us. So they were able to I think, bear the brunt of lots of the cuts. We've had this now for 14 years, and that's why I think, again, the political messaging was very bizarre, I would say, when you're coming out 3 weeks into government, was it, in the Rose Garden in the Downing Street, and saying things are going to get a lot worse before they get better. People don't want to hear that. Well, people want some hope. And
there wasn't much to cut. That's the problem. Yeah. There's such little left that the few kind of fragments of the social state is completely disappeared. And I think that's where, to me, my problems with the winter fuel stuff came in was, of course, taking money from old people, not good, and obviously optically looks bad. But to me, that was the end of universalism, where... Yeah. The kind of post-war consensus, which was, as a British citizen who pays into a system, you are entitled to this, irrespective of your background, which is what built the kind of latter part of the 20th century and informed a significant aspect of the labour movement, the aspirations of the labour movement throughout the 20th century. All of a sudden, that came and was collapsed within the first couple of months of a Labour government. And I think that's where some of the cynicism comes in, is because that distrust around... killing universalism or the concept of it, even for that boomer generation who benefited a lot more from the state than I think many people do today, demonstrated that Labour has departed, I think, from its original mission, which was to appoint dignity for everybody irrespective of your circumstances.
But I feel like the end of universalism is responsive to the fact that our demographic shift is huge. Like, you can stratify across our different ages, places, and richness as a result of that. You know, like, pensioners are so much wealthier than the young people today who are going out into the work markets, right? So do we have to be responsive to that change? And on the economics point, it's clear, you know, look globally, we are living through an economic revolution right now. That's why Trump, you know, if you want to make sense of why Trump's doing what Trump is doing, it's because they're trying to shake the machine. Yeah. They're trying to shake it up. And we have to be cognizant of that as a labour movement if we want to see the return of dignity and agency to working classes and working people.
Which I agree, but I don't think that comes from the surrendering of the Treasury to those said factors. I think, to a point, what Trump has done, and whether it's successful or not, but he's sought to reclaim power back into kind of democratic decision making, to assert the authority, to give confidence to people that those in elected office can do stuff.
Right.
And I think the absence of that now, and they hear you.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas sometimes to suggest that it's kind of a conspiracy of the world, and the Chancellor then has to respond to just how the world is, while she has a democratic mandate to do X, Y, and Z, it just fuels the narrative that politicians don't serve the people, that they don't really have the power that we perceive them to have. And they're not willing to challenge the vested power that kind of exists beyond the realities of ordinary life. And I think that's where the real kind of rot of politics can come in, is where concessions have been made by politicians that the world is as it is and we just have to respond to it. Therefore, we operate through cuts, or we just invest in this rather than reimagining the kind of foundations as to how the economy or how society or how politics should work.
And then you open the door as doing business as usual to a fringe right government as part of that sort of economic revolution.
Massive revolution,
idea that, you know, I think they junked it yesterday or Tuesday, but the idea that we're going to raise the tax threshold to 20 grand and everyone goes,
unbelievable.
I can't wait. I'm going to have loads more money. And you think,
100 million.
Where are we going to find...
Exactly. 100 billion gap,
Where are we going to fund things? But this is the problem. You listen to people like Richard Tice, who they say will be Chancellor if they win, and you listen to Rupert Lowe, was the one for me, and he's, you know, he's still the same. He believes that power should be totally centralised amongst the rich, and that is that. Mm. The way he used to... I was helping Barry Gardiner for a bit with his lines for things like GB News, and him and Rupert would be up against each other every Monday. And it was quite good. Barry's an intelligent bloke, Rupert's not daft, and therefore it was quite an interesting battle of wills. And it's a blame your neighbour politics, but based on the idea that we're all going to be rich one day and we're going to help you with that, when actually they are the biggest con men in Parliament. The idea that you're going to make all of us richer and you're not going to get anything out of it. It's the worst type of sort of political posturing.
Richard Tice funny you mention him, because there was a comment on one of our videos that Richard Tice donates his MP's salary. You'd never see Keir Starmer doing
Rupert
that.
Lowe does it.
And
yeah.
I was going to say, like, well, Richard Tice can, because he's invested loads of money into solar and net zero, which he also hates. So he's probably making a ton of money off that. So you don't need his MP salary,
I think,
mate.
That's totally great. No expenses.
They are grifters,
but
man.
That's the problem. He is, because he goes, well, because Parliament's made for people like me. Mm-hmm. He can pay all his own staff. Good, saves the taxpayer. I've got nothing against that.
Yeah.
But just because you can doesn't mean everyone else should be. He was saying politicians should be paid less. And we're going back to, in a sense, before Peterloo and the Great Reform Act, where constituencies would have six electors and it would be the richest people in the land. Cities like Manchester and Birmingham would have no MPs because there wasn't anyone there with the money, essentially. Mm-hmm. And you end up with a politics for literally the few.
The rich.
Rest of us just wallow in our own.
We see it, mate. We see it across the pond. You know, that is what they have. And I just think Reform want us to be America.
But I don't even think it's that. I think it's this very 19th century version of England is what they want. I don't think it's this kind of Musk-esque kind of almost modern innovative kind of economy that is kind of spearheaded by like millionaires and billionaires. I think it's just a bunch of quite wealthy people who can pursue politics as a pastime, who can make decisions that don't affect them, that have severe consequences for obviously their constituents, who have an ideological predisposition to privatizing, to kind of individualization, all of these kind of things, and they can just wield power and orchestrate society. I think it's just a very kind of outdated Victorian, nostalgic.
Well, it is, because if you look at the people Trump's got, regardless of my political differences, a lot of very clever people around him, right? Very clever, intelligent people with regards to campaigning, with regards to policies, with regards to economics. Reform ain't got any staff. So it is the brainchild of these Middle England posh old toff type. It is. So it isn't as sophisticated.
But they are attracting investment. I mean, the Tories are really struggling on that.
Yeah,
front.
But you know, I don't think they want it. I don't think they want to win. And I'll tell you why. I was talking to someone about this the other week. If they win,
this is conspiratorial. Listen,
I speak to Nigel's team a lot. They keep wanting a cup of coffee for me to go over, and I think I'm not being your token lefty, right, to show you're not a retired home for failed Tories. But I think he wants to be the Messiah. He wants to be so. Yeah. If he wins, he's got to face reality. He's got to start cutting. He's got to start doing something. People are going to be annoyed. Now, if he doesn't win, he can go down as the greatest prime minister we never had for lots of people. And he can be the martyr, not the messiah, the martyr. I'm the campaigner. I got us Brexit and the establishment never wanted me in there. And they never wanted me as prime minister. They turned it against me. They did this, they did that. And Chris Hope on GB News, actually, I caught it, asked him three times, do you want to be prime minister? He wouldn't answer it. Wouldn't that? Because he doesn't really want it. It's like a reverse Jeremy in a way. Like, he's ended up in a position where people are listening, people are watching him. We don't really want to end up winning at the end of it.
He just wants a nice paycheck.
Of course he does. That's what he's there for.
Nice job, Nigel, bro. Loves the money.
Of course he does. So I actually think he doesn't want it. Whether Tyson others do, I don't know. But Nigel doesn't want it. Nigel wants to be the martyr that nearly was, I think. That's where I put him.
I think it's also because it's hard to govern ideologically. Because institutions, as much as institutions are a consequence of ideology.
Look at least trust.
Exactly, exactly. And so, like, when your convictions are held so deeply that you're hostile or resistant to any compromise, why would you want power? Because
and this is what they're realising. So Tice going, oh, maybe we don't raise the tax threshold. That's a destination we would like to get to. That's called reality hitting you in the face.
Yeah.
The same will happen when other policies come to light. And this is what I mean. The idea of political momentum, I think, is a facade, because something could change tomorrow. He says the wrong thing, or Putin starts bombing us, and everyone goes, well, Canelli, he was a supporter years ago. You know what I mean? Things can happen very quickly. And also, if momentum is a thing, 4 years is a long time to keep momentum.
Yeah.
4 years is a long time for us to make it even worse, which I hope we don't. But I still think the time will come where scrutiny will get too much, and fantasy economics will be at play, and people won't believe it. My dad has finally become political in his 60s. I'd have loved to have had conversations with him properly about stuff over the years. And it's Reform. I sort of actually weirdly blame myself, because he started taking pride that his son was on the telly, right? And because a lot of my stuff came in with GB News, he started watching it in his spare time, not just watching me. And I think I spoke to Barry about it the other week. I said, I've started to wonder whether I should be going on there anymore. Because I think it's right that you don't ignore people. People watching that already feel ignored. If you don't turn up, you're proving them right. A majority of GB News viewers also voted Labour at the last election, so that can't be ignored. Mm. There's a consensus now that immigration has gone too far. That's one thing. But there's also a big anti-reform vote. Now, my argument is if it was that big, we'd have won in Runcorn. We wouldn't have lost by six. It needs to be bigger. You still had the Lib Dems getting 2,000 votes. You still had the Greens getting 2,000 votes. So you're hemorrhaging left and right, unfortunately. But what Nigel is doing is they're calling them Brexit populists. People that have never voted, voted in 2016, but they'll vote again because the idea is he could be Prime Minister. Yeah. And that'll be people like my dad. I mean, he voted Remain, but he don't really vote, don't really. But he started watching it, and I said to Barry, do you think we're now feeding the beast that will eventually eat us all? And this is because how long does it become a news channel when all it is doing is reflecting things you already believe in? I'm all for free speech and opinions. But is it really news when it's immigration every single day?
It's an entertainment show, man. I don't think Fox News has been a positive for democracy in America.
No, I think the irony is a lot of the generations that said video games would ruin our generation's minds, the mass media, the right-wing media lexicon, has totally radicalised all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you've got people genuinely in fear that Sadiq Khan's going to take their jewellery or that Barack Obama was going to come and dig up your guns from the back garden because they've seen it on Fox News, is terrifying. I think COVID did a bit of that. I had an auntie whose mind has totally melted because of stuff she's seen on the internet and believes now because it's almost like because the world stopped and we all just sat on our phones looking to do.
Someone in close family who's gone a bit mental because of the internet.
Yeah,
I've got a few to mind. Guys.
guys. To be fair, I'm all right.
You're all right. I'm all right. What's the secret? What's the secret? What's the secret? As soon as you leave London, you are slapped in the face by a completely different reality. And you have to ask yourself sometimes, how often do people from London, and I'm not just talking just about the political elite here, I'm just talking about people,
London people
leave London and really get to know and speak to people from other places? Not that often. Because if they did, then the media cast in this country wouldn't have reacted so strongly on the left to the immigration messaging, right? Mm. Because then the YouGov polling came out and it went, actually, most people in this country feel this way about this stuff.
And they can't get over it. I had a coffee with someone from the lobby last week and they were like, it's terrible, isn't it, this sort of stuff. And I thought, well, listen, maybe the Enoch Powell reference maybe wasn't very useful for lots of people. But ultimately, I think a majority of Lib Dem members that were polled think immigration is too high. If you're annoying the woolly Lib Dems and, you know, all the rest of it, then obviously there's something that has to be done. Electorally, just for survival, let alone the economics of it and the fact that London alone, it's astounding that people don't get it in London. I suppose if they live comfortable lives, they wouldn't get it. London is spending £4 million a day on temporary accommodation.
When I found that out, I couldn't believe it, yeah.
But that's the money that should be going into things like social care and schools and everything. Exactly, well, we're all paying for
this. You know what's funny? I got a trim today, as you can probably tell. But with my barber, he's from Morocco, and I was like, have you heard about this immigration stuff? Like, the government's cracking down on it. And he's come in the last 5 years and he works hard, right? This guy's a grafter.
Most people do. This
and he was just like, well, look, some people are taking the piss.
Hold on.
This is my thing with my liberal left wealthy friends. You know, go and talk to some actual people from this background and they will tell you the reality.
You'll find most second gen will go, yeah, don't be letting all them lie. I mean, like, we're in. They're the nightmare.
That is my family. So I don't have any like COVID kind of batshit crazy people, but I do have
racist
immigrants.
But it is that like that sense of fairness or unfairness where people who, irrespective of their ethnic background or whatever, it's that kind of Britishness that people have of like, actually, you know what, there are some people who are taking liberties.
I came here and grafted, and I bet them lot aren't, because they're watching the same telly we are.
There's a bit of nonsense there about, like, you know, sorry, my phone went off there.
Everybody's on the take.
Well, there's a bit of nonsense there about, like, people are getting a hyper scapegoating, and I accept that we should call that out, but I think we have to be honest that our civic identity is probably based on something like, I give in, we get out. Mm. You know, I contribute. We've got to create this thing together.
This is it. And kind of turn into a different point, but like, around the social contract, that whole thing has been completely cut up, destroyed. The obligations from the government or the state to its own people is almost non-existent now. That's why the government can do whatever.
I think it's getting about touching grass. Like, people need to get out of their echo chambers. And the problem about that is that most people don't want to. Like, we've been laissez-faire about this stuff for so long, about community integration. And I'm speaking about this, we put a clip out on immigration. It kind of did a little numbers. But like, one of the comments, actually, let me read the comment out, because I said I'd respond to it, and he said, leave it to people with critical thinking skills. So Matt, you can answer the question. The reason why you get government saying that they're going to lower immigration, they don't do it, is because they can't. And anyone who's not acknowledging that fact is a liar. And my point is that, that's partly true. That's why governments didn't do it. But that doesn't negate the fact that there are plenty of people in the society who have what potentially legitimate grievances about this problem at the community level, at the lived experience level, as much as they might also be getting led astray by scapegoating and the right wing as well. Two things can be true. That's how I feel about it. But you have critical thinking skills, so you please please correct me if I'm wrong there.
No, I think governments could stop it tomorrow for all intents and purposes. If we wanted to leave the ECHR, we could do it. If we wanted to pass a one-line bill saying we are building a fence across the whole border of Dover and at the bottom of the country, we could do it. We can leave whatever international mechanisms we want, essentially. We've seen this during Brexit. You could argue you need a mandate, but if you want, somebody wanted to do it, they could do it. I think it's widely known that the Treasury quite likes cheap labour coming in. It helps productivity and growth. Therefore, they're all for immigration a lot of the time. As long as you're coming here working, you're not draining us. I look at what Robert Jemrich said in response to Keir's speech last week, and it's scaremongering to the levels of what the BNP... It's BNP language, right? Yeah, the idea of the homogenous, white-born, the indigenous community, blah, blah, blah.
Indigenous Brits,
yeah. This is it. And it's like, first of all, historically lazy and whatever else, but that's the shit Nick Griffin used to come out with. We're talking about indigenous people. He means white, right? He means, we all know he means white.
What's interesting to me just on that point is that all these people grew up in a multicultural society now. There's no one that's alive today that hasn't experienced multiculturalism. So what they're referring to is non-existent, at least in their lifetimes, but is this kind of nostalgia that, even to a point in British history, in quite recent British history, hasn't existed in the way that they're articulating it today. So it's largely a load of nonsense.
And all we do is shift the scapegoat on, and now it's the time of essentially Muslims. I think at this current juncture, it's frightening, because of the way it is amplified and beamed into your sons and daughters, essentially, mobile phones, into their bedrooms. Yeah. Also because the amount of countries now that appear to be on the precipice of war, if not already, are at war. You look at the Middle East, you look at Ukraine, you look at Kashmir. We're heading for like a West versus East whole scenario if we're not careful. And even that idea of like, they're different from you. And it's always people that have never met Muslims, ever. And this is the thing. This is why the difference you see with Gen Z, they're the least patriotic, but also the most accepting and tolerant of immigration. I got asked, well, why do you think that is? Well, first of all, there's nothing to be proud of when, the idea you're never going to get on the housing ladder. You're not going to be able to borrow enough money. You're leaving uni with 50, 60 grand's worth of debt. All these sort of negative things. You've not got no public services. Everything's shit, right? But they're most accepting and tolerant because, as you said rightly, they've all grown up in a multicultural society. So their mate, who they play footy with every lunchtime, he might go and pray at lunchtime, but you know what? He's sound. I don't mind. His mum makes nice food, actually, as well, when I go around for tea. No one's asked.
It's spicy, though, isn't it?
No, yeah. No, but no one is asked. It's the elder generations that are struggling with it, and it's trying to strike at a core of essentially white people's cultural identity that were being eradicated. And I don't know, I might be a traitor, but I just think, I'm not asked. And maybe that's just on me, and maybe I'm really liberal. And I find it astounding that Spain was a Muslim country 500 years ago. That's mad considering how religious they are now. But you know what? That's just times. Times change. All sorts of cultural things
it's
happen.
It's also just quite ignorant, I think, historically ignorant, to not comprehend that Britain had a global presence for 400 or 500 years. And so, I mean, of course, when you've got such an intricate history with people from around the world, from the West Indies all the way to kind of the Far East, I think it's just historically lazy more than anything.
No, it is. Before the British Nationality Act, 600 million people had the right to come and settle here as Commonwealth citizens. So are we surprised they all came here, especially when we plundered all the wealth and brought it back with us? Exactly. No one's coming here for the weather, let's have it right.
My grandparents moved from one part of Britain to another part, and it was 3 weeks on a ship from Africa to the UK.
Did they move on a banana boat? same with my grandma. Same, bro. She genuinely did. You just don't hear people talking about it, but we have a common and shared heritage that is global. And I think this is where I think that, like, part of the Labour's mission should be uniting the left on this front. Because actually, when you speak to Lib Dems and you speak to Greens, we're not too far. We've got different agendas. We're not too far away from each other. But I think we do have a sense of our place internationally. As an internationalist community.
Is core to a kind of social democratic mission. It's recognising that as people, we're social beings. It doesn't matter where you come from, that there is cooperation and prosperity to be shared and embraced by everybody. I think that is the essence.
But I think internationalism doesn't necessarily de facto mean that you don't have borders and you don't exercise control over immigration. I think it's completely legitimate for countries in an internationalist world where we have cooperation between nation states to still enforce at some level control over their borders, especially if that's what, when you live in a democracy, your electorate wants you to do.
Well, because I think internationalism, I think in this era, is more rooted in the fact that we are totally globally connected, right? You know, the information can be passed around like that, the trade deals that we do. And I think, again, I talk about war a lot because it's due. We're due a war, right?
We're hurtling in that direction.
It terrifies me that we seem to be sleepwalking into it. And more now than ever, I voted mostly. I was a reluctant Remainer, but I voted Remain based on the fact that we need interconnected allyship, right? And actually, now we look at America, who is showing themselves to not be an ally that can be dependent on. I'm all for being closer with lots of different countries.
Absolutely, likewise.
And it's essential.
And I think that's why the UK-EU deal was really important, because what we know it signal now, the thing is, countries that are not America and China... Mm. And kind of Russia from the military perspective.
India as well.
I mean, India's the next will be the... I mean, this is the multipolarity that we're about to go live in. A rebalancing of powers. Hopefully with that, actually, a reordering of powers as well. Because disorder right now is possibly what's causing the level of chaos and conflict that we're seeing as well. The UK can only become a proper player and recognising its actual place. We're not a big superpower anymore, right? Is by creating some form of alliance with other nation states that want to create a form of cooperation on the global
based
scale.
Based upon shared values. And I think that's where the kind of internationalism thing comes in, is Britain has a sense of itself and is confident about what it believes. And I go back to kind of British values, and if we're talking about ideas of integration, who we are as a people, so we can kind of march forward into this kind of new world, having a sense of direction for ourselves and our country. I mean, as we're saying, I don't want to live in a country where people are sleeping on the streets, or children can't, they're too poor to have their dinners, or people are going to food banks or whatever it is. We need to eradicate these problems at home, because that kind of inspires a sense of ourselves and work collaboratively and with solidarity with countries who may have those challenges, but also who want to go around with that kind of moral mission of humanity going forward. I think that is essential for any Labour government. That is the core of our democratic socialist fibre.
When we've got no money, it's other pots of money that we can delve into. Another big thing for me during the referendum was local aspects. Most estates in Greater Manchester that are deprived had free broadband fitted by the European Union. Yeah. The government wouldn't be able to do that. I wouldn't have thought...
But they didn't know
that,
did they?
Nah, even the IRA bombed us in the 90s. We got 900 grand from John Major's government. We got 20 million quid from the European Union as part of a long-term rebuilding mechanism. Right. And that's why it's a bit naive, but like, I don't mind cozying up to any country, in a sense, because if they want to help us out, fine. I'd rather them not be putting spyware in the solar panels. But, you know, if we can't afford it, you're sort of... And not as a big superpower anymore, not as a global empire, not essentially plundering and taking wealth from other people. We're going to have to rely on other countries. That's as simple as it is.
Just turning to that then, what do you think of the cut in international aid?
The international aid thing, listen, I didn't like it. I think electorally... it's probably not a bad thing. Try selling that around Birmingham.
Yeah, it's impossible.
But you go down Bartley Green, people don't care. Like, what are you giving all them lot money for? We ain't got any money around here. So there's that. I think also it goes to show that, you know, there's lots of people having input into number 10. I had a coffee with somebody who is unelected and has his entrails very much in number 10, despite not working there, and showed me text to the extent that it was his idea. He was telling Morgan in number 10, you need to do this, cut the aid budget. It was a card to show, look, we are doing our bit invest but in our army for Ukraine and whatnot, because Trump was like, well, we're dragging our feet, it's all us. So it was a way of going, no, look, Donald, we've done that, and there's the king, and there's, so they totally. Yeah, but
the problem is that foreign aid has a branding problem because it's got the word foreign in it, and people don't realise that that stuff helps us from the lens of security. We're downstream of loads of events. If you want to stop migration, make sure that those countries are safe for people to live in, right? This is one of the hugest, biggest pushes of migratory movements, right? So we've got to kind of extol the virtues of it, and we're not doing that. And that's part of our mission. But I do think that it's all by design. It's all intentional to undermine internationalism, because the project of Trump and his ilk is to create a nativist, ethno-nationalist project.
But it's also to disrupt. And I think it is trying to hegemonize their world order
against globalization.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think this is where there's a lot of opportunity in kind of the political discourse, is to capitalize on the disruption and use it to our own kind of progressive ends, and work in solidarity with nations around the world to kind of realize a mission that is bigger than us all and responds to some of the greatest challenges. Because we're not going to respond to climate change or huge changes in migratory patterns and all of these things if there isn't some semblance that we can work together, and that the new order that is trying to be pushed isn't one that is credible in or sufficient in responding to the challenges.
The last round, I was shouting, Rastafari, lick him up, lick him up, Rastaf, lick him up, lick him, not got him. I got into the feeling.
You've obviously spoken about your dad. He seems to be like quite a big influence on you, but you've also had quite a difficult life, right? You got kicked out of home. How did you repair your relationship? Because I feel like, from the perspective of like masculinity, which is obviously a big hot topic at the moment, one thing we don't talk about enough is like our relationships with our fathers. And I think it is one of the most determinate and important things that shapes who we are. So you guys have had a colourful experience. You know, how did you pull that back together?
Counselling, good advice, dropping my own barriers, in a sense. So my dad was a big part in the sense of he took me to football every week. I played football for a little bit. I've had about 7 different lives when I think about it. I joke about it a lot with the missus. She's like, when did you do this job? And when it's like, oh, honestly, this whole story. But he was the one. He'd be there every week. He took great pride in it. I was half decent, especially as a younger lad, and he used to buzz off it. Like, there was one season in particular, I was under 15s. Every goal was a 30-yard screamer. I scored 30 goals that year. Honestly, I didn't score a normal goal. Like Louis Sahar back in the day, I'd miss the sitters, but I'd ping the top bags, free kicks, the whole lot. And he'd be stood behind the goal, and you'd see him go nuts and that. We didn't talk about stuff. In a way, you know what I mean? Like, we'd have silly senses of humour, we'd both be daft, but we wouldn't talk about stuff. I never ever, from mum and dad, had the birds and bees conversation ever. I think maybe just as the eldest, they were figuring out how to be parents as well. Yeah, no, I didn't speak to mum and dad for probably the best part of a decade. And I used to have friends, I don't know if it's an estate thing, but lads I'd meet up from back home would go, you should speak to them, you know. You only get one mum and dad. Anyway, I tried 4 or 5 times to make, essentially, you know, repair the relationship. I don't think mum and dad were ready either. Maybe 3 years ago, I gave up drinking, realised I was an alcoholic. The counselling I'd been waiting on, having tried it 3 or 4 times, just didn't work, didn't fit. I don't think I was totally ready to bare my soul, in a sense, and be honest with the therapist. That kicked in around the time that I decided to give up drinking. I was entering in a new phase in life, if that makes sense. What did I do? I went round at Christmas and sort of surprised them, which could have gone one or two ways. But I knew they'd been asking about me. Right. And
had you had no contact kind of prior?
Nah, I went round to my brother's, who lives across the road from my mum and dad. So I went, I stayed at my brother's, and then I went round with a couple of small Christmas gifts, and they were surprised. Just little by little, I've had this relationship with them where they're proud of me now. And actually, the big turning point, my counsellor said, was I was still working in Parliament, and he invited my dad down. And I'd wanted him, I knew myself, if he could see it with his own eyes, because he couldn't understand what I did, it's not their world, yeah, he'd get it, and he'd be like, he's done all right. It's that typical thing, you hear it a lot from people, but never said they were proud of us. We weren't a loving, close, hug-and-kiss family. It was just not their way of parenting. And that's not like a woe-is-me thing, it's just how they did things. Mm. He came down, Ange had done PMQs because Keir was away. She was on the terrace and Ange grew up down the road from us. She was like, all right, mate, how's it going? I was like, Dad, you want to go and have a word to the next Deputy Prime Minister? He's like, oh, we're from Stockport as well. Yeah. Robert buzzing that he'd met her on the terrace. Barry knew how much it would mean to me because he knew about my, you know, story, and I've spoke to him at length about it. And what was really the icing on the cake was, and he rang and said, are you still here? I said, no, I'm on the escalator going into West. He said, come back up, I'm here now. And he knew how buzzing my dad would be. And he said, you know, you've got an amazing son. Went the whole, didn't need to say all that. And Dad was like, I know, I'm really proud of him. Dad said his best day. Changed his Facebook picture, me and him on the terrace. And my counsellor said, I saw a change in you like that.
Really?
The week after. And I said, I know, it's like something I'd always needed, and I knew I needed it. And I'd finally got it.
You know, when you look back now at where you've come from and to where you've got to, do you feel in a certain way that, like, obviously some of the shit you went through was unbelievably difficult, but it made you?
Not until recently. I have always said, and I wouldn't like to take credit in a weird way, that I was helped by lots of people. I didn't do any of it on my own. My best friends, mum and dad, Dawn and Paul, took me in. And if they didn't, that, you know, who knows? My English teacher doing GCSE English at college, Neil, was amazing. He got me political. My head of university course, Karen Kinghorn, and Dr. Emily Whittaker. It was a lot of women, actually, as well. That's the total maternal thing, maybe. Saw something in me and helped me get to that next step. I've done none of it on my own. And Dawn texted me not so long ago, my best friend's mum, and said, I said, listen, I've got, it's all you that I've got to thank. And that's how I believed it. And she said, yeah, but what you forget is you had to have something within you in the first place to not give up and carry on. And I'd never actually thought about it in that way and thought, well, is it that thing of tough times make you stronger? Just being resilient or whatever, I don't know, is the truth. But I think there must be something, there's got
to
be.
If there's a working class lad watching this show right now who's thinking, this, how do I get to that next stage, and they're finding it difficult, what is your piece of advice to them?
It's hard because you can also be put down in those environments that are supposed to raise you, like school. And that's not to say all teachers are bad. People have probably got similar stories where I went to see the careers advisor and she said, what do you want to do? And I said, play football. And she said, oh, whatever. And then, because my mum said, read the news, be a journalist. I didn't even know what a journalist was at that age. I had no idea. And she said, oh, they write the newspapers. And I was like, oh, I'm good at writing, you know what I mean? And she said, I don't think it'd be something you'll be able to do. And the problem was, is because I preferred the laughter of failure. I was a class clown. I think I won class clown in year 11, biggest clown in the school. I know it's the only thing I left. No GCSEs, but, you know, class clown. But that's the thing. I think what my therapy taught me is, I didn't get the attention at home. And my mum would say, why are you such an attention seeker? She didn't realise because I didn't get it from her. So I loved the laughter of everybody else and I got that kick and whatever else.
Almost at the expense of yourself, would
you
say? Yeah,
totally. Oh, everyone else probably passed through school and are doing other stuff. I was totally homeless and, you know, not laughing anymore, put it that way. But I needed something. I think the imposter syndrome will be different for everybody. I had it in Parliament, totally, at the first couple of years. I think the best bit of advice is to keep going, as daft as that sounds, because what I eventually found out is that when I had a little bit of power and could do things, or was running campaigns, or was doing comms or whatever, and it worked, not always, but it then worked, you'd go, oh, I can totally do this.
Where I grew up, there are so many capable, intelligent people. I saw this when I was standing for Parliament as well in Clacton, that I really do believe that intelligence, talent, capacity, capability is completely evenly distributed across this country, and I've got no reason to think otherwise, because at least from my own experiences, there are intelligent people everywhere and there are stupid people everywhere. There are capable and incapable people everywhere too, But knowing that some people get access to things, even still in 2025, when we're attempting to curb some of these kind of injustices, that some people are beneficiaries in part because their parents can just pay for things, or they have access to things and therefore know how to navigate certain things and will occupy the top jobs, was one of the most infuriating things I could have observed.
You spoke earlier about resilience. I think the other problem is if you pay your kids through life, they don't build up resilience because they've never faced rejection, and that therefore you end up with essentially a certain type of politician in many ways that doesn't understand. I think look at Boris Johnson, right? The guy's never been held accountable for anything ever. And that's because he's never had to face that resilience. Everything is owed to him. How would you know, and that's it, plays into the toxic masculinity. I'm not saying that's Boris, but what do you mean you won't go out with me? Everyone goes out with me, you know what I mean? You belong to me, and all this sort of behaviour. You have to face rejection in life, because if you don't, you're building up your kids to essentially be totally mollycoddled, hopeless, anxious basket cases. Like that's the
truth. I think our generation's got a bit of a problem with it, to be honest. And I do think we haven't been parented in the way that enables us. And maybe this is partly because of the advances in technology and social media as well, but like where we're allowed to fail. And that's making us quite soft when it comes, because failure is inevitable and you're going to have to deal with those things, as you just pointed out. And I think Gareth Southgate said a similar thing in his lecture. I agree, like we need to normalize like falling on your face and not laughing in the face of failure right? But these are huge shifts that we're talking about at the social level to enable these like positive shoots to then grow.
But I definitely, and I've said this before elsewhere, I definitely noticed a shift in people's attitudes to parenting after Madeleine McCann. And there's this idea, and whether it's the internet also sending push notifications about every murder, rape and whatever possible, there's an idea that you can protect your kids from everything, and you can't. I think because of that, you parent with fear and then therefore mollycoddle the kids so they grow up. There's a reason why a lot of our young people are totally anxious and mental health, ridden with poor mental health. Kids are going to fall out of trees and break their arm. That doesn't mean you shouldn't let them climb the tree. That's part of childhood. And when they break their arm, they'll be fine. You get it fixed. And then that's it. That's part of going, well, I better be careful when I climb the tree next time. But you learn from good and bad experiences.
On you live it, learn, like learning from mistakes being central to personal growth. Mm. And I completely believe in that and buy into that. The prison reform stuff that's just dropped recently, as someone who had to go through, you didn't go to prison, but you went through the criminal justice system. What do you make of the government, David Gork's recommendations?
It's liberal ideas with a conservative ethos. I also thought it was interesting that the go-to for lots of us that are involved in prison reform would be to look at Scandinavia, Norway, Holland, etc. Mm. They chose Texas. Therefore, you can't be saying, well, you know, liberal Texas.
When the outcomes are Texan.
Exactly. So I think it's absolutely right that you should, if you're set, no way you should be doing less than a year in prison. Pointless, totally pointless. The way I see prison is you've got to learn from it. The idea was, my barrister told me and friends that I've got in prison told me exactly the same, is you do a year, cut in half about good behaviour, and then you also get 2 months took off. So I'd do 4 months. What am I learning in four months? Probably getting put in two separate prisons because they've got to find space for you. So straight away, you're not even settling. There's no education going to be done in that time. You just have your civil liberties taken away for 4 months. And that's sort of it. So are you coming out of the process a better person and rehabilitated? Probably not. You may not have even took accountability for it because you're angry at the world. There absolutely needs to be more of a focus on community sentencing, and people will go, well, no, you need to throw away the key and lock people up and whatever else. The thing is with community sentencing is it shouldn't be seen as an alternative to prison, as in it's a lesser sentence. It's an alternative because the same sort of stuff happens. You might not get locked up, but you'll be on tag and you've got a curfew. Yeah. It's still going to ruin your life, especially if it's put on the internet somewhere, depending on what you've done. Your family and friends may still fall out with you. And ultimately, you still can't get on in life. The only difference is you're not in a cell, which costs us £54,000 per year per prisoner. And restorative justice is the one that doesn't get spoken about a lot. Yeah. There's something very powerful and has changed a lot of minds when it's happened to them about bringing the victim together with the accuser, if that's what they want, with the perpetrator. And them seeing that they haven't just burgled a random house to get the money to get their fix. they're seeing the human life impact of that lady not being able to go to bed at night and having to put extra locks on the doors, mm-hmm. and the trauma it's impacted, and she was worried they were going to take her son in the cot, or we can't, I wake up in the night now and da-da-da. And you're feeling that empathy because you're not hopefully a sociopath or you know, somebody that's that way inclined. You're going, I can't keep living like this. Mm. So not only are they getting some element of closure of going, you've done this to me, and I don't know if I can forgive you, but you're sorry, so maybe I do forgive you. Mm. But you're cutting the costs that it's costing. Because reoffending costs us 20 billion quid a year nearly.
Yeah.
That is not sustainable.
The recidivism rate's so high, and also that we're an outlier on that as well, like compared to Spain, for instance, which doesn't have such high levels of reoffending.
And you get, well, yeah, and you get the idea of tougher sentences. People still commit crimes. Yeah. It's supposed to be a deterrent. Well,
we're not just going to punish our way out of this problem, right?
I think you're not going to build your way out of it as well. I know the government's, for obvious reasons, politically said, well, we're going to build thousands more prison places. That's fine in one instance.
But we have to do that when the prisons are full. Like, it is necessary.
But economically, we've just built a brand new prison, HMP Millsike, for half a billion quid. You've got 1,500 places. Mm. So the idea that an Iceland supermarket has been put in a jail in Birmingham is a good thing. You're normalising category C and D prisoners for the outside world when they're going to be released. Why don't we open it to the public? A bit like we have the Clink restaurants and we train people up. Why don't we get people to the idea of a stressful environment of lots of people coming towards the till and you're building them up ready for work? And that money can be used for them when they get out. Don't even necessarily give it them now. It was actually bizarrely Lee Anderson told me he went to the last government with an idea. He said, I'm not against second chances. I'm not always against third chances in some cases. He said, what you could be doing is letting people go out as they do. If they're category C and D, and they go out on ROTL, which is temporary license, and they go out at a weekend, they might go and work and see the friends and family, and it's to build relationships back up and normalise things, but they've got to be back for 11 o'clock Sunday night, otherwise you're getting extra time, and you have your key to your own cell and whatever else, all quite open. Now, maybe they don't get that money straight away. Maybe it gets put in a pot. Maybe that puts down a deposit for a house, because otherwise we're releasing people with £50 travel voucher, nowhere to go, friends and family maybe not speaking to them depending what they do.
So what do they
kids
do?
Kids took off them.
Exactly,
well, you're on the street committing crime, obviously, and therefore that feeds back into the 20 billion
straight back in. I spoke to a judge and said to me basically that most judges wouldn't be against getting rid of these really short sentences. And they're aware that the public want people to be punished and want people to go to jail, because it's about trying to reinforce that the criminal justice system is working on their behalf. But then they end up seeing that same person again 2.5 years later, and they think actually what you needed there was better community sentencing, more skills training, better protection and support into figuring out what they want to do afterwards. And it's like, okay, well then, if the experts are saying this, how do we make this politically acceptable? Because when we really talk about the issues that, and we've spoken about so many issues over the last couple of hours, this one is unfortunately right down at the bottom of what people care about their money being spent on, right? They want the criminal justice system to make them feel safe. They don't want to make the criminal justice system be a place for reformation, even though that is in its core
values.
Listen, there's
no votes in treating prisoners nice.
No, and there's never been. And there never will be. And unfortunately, there never will be. But you've got to say, though, when the prison population has grown at this exponential rate that it's got to now, where the prisons are full, what's going on? Like, what are we doing differently? What's happened here?
It's about reframing the message a lot of the time as well. Listen, it's hard to do. You need to speak in very black and white terms. But I was trying to use the example of the early release scheme last summer. And lots of people, particularly on the right, were going, well, you know, because they just want to have a go at Keir sometimes. And I partly get that, but, you know, it's just unfair. Because he's been put in a very awkward position, right, with the prisons. And there's a lot of this stuff that's going to happen with councils going bankrupt and all this other stuff that the Tories have left as like unplanted bombs in a way. But the 93% of those that left on early release ended up back within the last 12 months. This one was going, yeah, exactly, silly releasing them. I said, no, that shows me prison doesn't work. If they're not ready to be released, they were going to be released in 2 or 3 months anyway. So if they were still going to go back, why are they going back? And why are we not asking these deeper questions? I think the win the government can have is the fact that you've literally employed James Timpson as the prisons minister.
Yeah, yeah.
I have never heard anybody of any political persuasion go, what a sausage he is. Imagine employing criminals in your shops. People go, what an amazing thing. He's done really well. Look at these lives he's changed. give him the political space exactly, to talk to about so. Why we should this empower is a good him. Thing.
I think so. Yeah.
Now let them focus on fringe parts of it, like sex offenders and violent people and whatever else. Listen, we paint lots of people as violent. There's something very different about a drunken scrap that's gone wrong and somebody who is a vicious, deeply troubled individual. Yeah, and that's the other thing we've got. You can't just paintbrush the whole lot and tar everybody with the same sort of brush. By that extent, I'm a fraudster and I'll always be that, a con man, and people will never trust me and whatever else. It doesn't work like that if you give people opportunity. So we have to have a question about political priorities. Do you want your taxpayers' money to be continued to be spent? Maybe they do want it on locking people up and the fact that reoffending puts them all in there. Or do you want to get to a point where these people get on in life and we all pay less in tax because there's more people paying into the pot?
Well, on that, you know, the chemical castration thing, I mean, like, that to me, obviously popular policy, right? And it's a difficult one because I guess part of the kind of liberal conscious, haughty, like, you know, university thinker goes, well, what if somebody, you know, is innocent, you know, what about miscarriages of justice? Is that an infringement on liberty rights if it's not voluntary? And I acknowledge that, but I also acknowledge from the other side, like, this is the worst crime possible, right? What do you make of...
It was unpalatable when I read it. I thought, oh, okay. I thought David Gork looked a little... I caught him on Sky News. I know he did a bit of the round yesterday morning and night. He didn't seem comfortable talking about it. Now, he's obviously been fed in as he's the chair of the sentencing review, right? But his demeanour changed and he didn't really want to talk about it so much. He spoke about the fact that, you know, this would be looked at and considered, and there's a trial in the Southwest, which I wasn't aware of until yesterday.
That's voluntary, right?
That's my understanding. Yeah. The reports say that the Justice Minister would like to make it mandatory.
Yeah, with a view to make it mandatory.
I don't know.
Do you think it's carrot and stick, though? Do you think it's like they're trying to say, look, to the wider public, you can get this thing that you want, but you're going to have to accept the short releases in response?
It's the uncomfortability of the state being so invasive, so much so that they, to a point, enter the biology of somebody to curb a particular behaviour. These people are awful people. These people are... They are disgusting people, as far as I'm concerned, and they really do deserve some form of punitive punishment because they are unsafe to many people. But I think where the state becomes an invasive force, where it starts to mandate how people's bodies can kind of respond or be controlled in a particular way, sets a very particular precedent that if it can be trialled on prisoners, who is the next person where the next thing can be trialled upon, and the next thing, and the next thing. And I think that's where I can imagine he probably has some uncomfortability. I'm not speaking obviously on behalf of him, but at least that's where I have my uncomfortability around it, because I think in no way should the state have the capacity to mandate a particular thing in your own biology. And yeah, I think it's quite discomforting that is at least seen as a viable option or a credible way of solving this problem.
I think to sell the liberal stuff, this is the conservative thing they've thrown in, because people aren't probably willing to accept short sentences. They aren't maybe potentially willing to accept people coming out after a third of their sentence if they've behaved, or half if they've been violent or otherwise. So I tell you what, we'll chemically castrate the pedos. All right, well, I might get on board with that sort of stuff then. The reason it made me feel uncomfortable is partly what you said, but my first thought was, that's what they did to Alan Turing.
That's what I thought.
For the sake of being gay. That's what people said the same to me. They were like, that's my... And even they, some of the more right-wing people I know have gone, yeah, I don't know, you know, it's a bit... And again, it's... I can't expect we're going to legalise being a nonce anytime soon, obviously, no. But...
And I would hope not.
Like you, yeah, quite. Yeah. But, like you said, what will be the next thing of, well, we'll do this? I suppose it begs the question.
You're talking about state and individual rights, right? Yeah, exactly. I think that's where we feel uncomfortable.
About what do you do about it? You know, essentially.
The last question before we wrap, Matt. I think the thing that I wonder is that if there is somebody who's watching this show out there, who has got a situation with like a family member or somebody close in their life that they are out of touch with and feel unrepaired about it, what is the message that you want to send to those people?
I had a lot of people say to me, you know, you got to think about any regrets you've got when they might not be here. And that's a common one. Part of me was like, well, you know, such is life if that's the case. I think you have to think about regrets, but in a way, it's not for me to say what they should do. But because it's, there may be very good reasons why they don't speak to them. I would always advocate it is beneficial probably to your mental health and spiritual health, your closure, if you try to make amends.